Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak. I want to welcome you once again. There's some great things going on, my friends. There's going to be a march on the governor's house. A march on the governor's house. If you do a search on the Facebook for the Stone Crab Alliance, you'll hear more details about it. One if by land, two if by sea. By God, it's a number three. They're going both ways. So make sure you find out about it. Also, next week, there's a conference called the Accountability Conference. Make sure you attend it. Progressives from across the state will be getting together in Orlando, a nice central location. Be involved with the people that are doing the work. There are people coming from across the state every day who are engaged in making this a better world. Come on down. The Progressive Coalition, Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, is very engaged in working both within and without the party structure to make this a better place to live. Florida, we live here. We need to make it work for people, for working families. So come on down, get together, help out. I'm sure you've heard about the several victories we've had recently. The good people of Stone Crab Alliance and Preserve Our Paradise out in the West Coast have gotten the state to actually stop drilling. Stopping drilling. That's amazing. Of course, now the battle's not over. The war has just begun. The Texas drillers have come back. They're now suing the state to get their permits reinstated. But it was people power. It was people power that stopped it, and you can be involved. Tonight's guest, a phenomenal roundup. We've got Steve Horn, a fellow with DeSmog Blog, who will be coming down to talk to us about how Alec, you've heard of Alec, now they're in league with the frackers. So Steve's going to tell us about the research he's done on that front. Kofi Hunt's going to give us a preview of next week's accountability conference in Orlando. Make sure you tune in for that. Houston Cypress from the Otter Tribe is going to come and talk to us. A wonderful gentleman. He grew up in the swamps of the Florida Everglades. Endangered beauty, the natural environment made such an impression on him during his childhood, being a refuge for his ancestors and a source of traditional plant medicines, that today he articulates the strategies for preserving this World Heritage Site. Also, we've got excerpts from two speeches of Senator Elizabeth Warren, one on the ridiculous costs of college tuition for students, and also a wonderful speech, a heartwarming speech about tax policy she gave in the Senate. Both things that you should know about. And then our final guest of the evening, the incomparable Miss Meredith Ochman, recently elected as the Southeast Regional Representative National Organization of Women. So it's going to be great, but now the news. Obama's spy chief, liars, spying on Congress for Obama. And that's so bad they should be fired, says an editorial. And of course, as always, you're going to go to averyvoice.com. Averyvoice.com, you can get all the details, all the links to all the news stories, the ones we read, the ones we just get to do a little bit on. So make sure you check that out. James Clapper and John Brennan lied to the Congressional Investigation Intelligence Committee. That's very bad. Bad enough that they should be fired. And their agencies spied on members of Congress and then they denied it. That's really bad. Bad enough that they should be fired. And combining with lying to Congress, they should be prosecuted and jailed. But President Obama says he's okay with that. He trusts Clapper. He trusts Brennan. Well, okay. You know, they're spying on Congress for him. The way this editorial sees it, that lying and spying done under the leadership of Brennan and Clapper was done for Obama. They should put him in the crosshairs of investigation and accusations by Congress and the DOJ. Obama finally got caught. He's covering up for criminals who lied and spied for him. Obama should not be able to protect Clapper and Brennan. Congress should be screaming bipartisan bloody murder. How can they do oversight if the spying agencies spy on Congress and thwart the investigations? Many would say that he and members of Congress have no choice. The spying done on them was worked, and they must back down because they're being blackmailed. That's certainly believable. This is a dangerous situation that must be corrected. Hearings by the Senate Select Committee aimed at terminating the jobs and exploring penitentiary possibilities for Clapper and Brennan would be a good first step. Failure to do so would show just how derelict, at best, or maliciously part of the conspiracy to allow unrestrained spy agency abuses. That's what Dianne Feinstein thinks. Dead zone in the Gulf is now the size of Connecticut. Scientists say that a man-made dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is as big as the state of Connecticut. The zone, which is about 5,000 square miles, that's 13,000 square kilometers, is the second largest in the world, but still smaller than in previous years, is so named because it contains no oxygen or too little at the Gulf floor to support even bottom-dwelling fish and shrimp. Primary cause for the annual phenomena is excess nutrient runoff from the farms along the Mississippi River, which empties into the Gulf, said Gene Turner, researcher at the Louisiana State University Coastal Ecology Institute. The nutrients feed algae growth, which consumes oxygen when it works its way to the Gulf bottom, he said. It's a poster child for how we're using and abusing our natural resources, Turner said. Turner said that the zone was at least twice in recent years reached the size of Massachusetts, about 8,200 square miles. The Gulf dead zone, which fluctuates in size but measures 5,052 square miles this summer, is exceeded only by a similar one in the Baltic Sea around Finland. The number of dead zones worldwide currently totals more than 550 and has been increasing for decades, according to a report by Turner and Nancy Rebelais from the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. The elongated Gulf zone typically hugs the Louisiana coast from Mississippi Delta to the state's border with Texas. In some years, extends offshore of Texas and Mississippi, Rebelais said. Scientists say it's a growth in the farming land along the Mississippi River in the 1960s began increasing pollution. In the 1970s, levels of oxygen in parts of the Gulf fell to needs of bottom-dwelling fish. The zone has been generally growing ever since. The report said the federal policy impacts the amount of pollution in the river. Turner said that cornfields, which lay bare most of the year and leach nutrients, are one of the biggest contributors to the problem. The federal task force organized with river states in 2001 to reduce nutrient runoff has no substantial success, he said. Public Service Commission? Are you kidding? 2 weeks ago, more than 100 members of the Sunshine State Clean Energy Coalition descended upon the Public Service Commission's hearings in Tallahassee as it reviewed energy companies' request to reduce efficiency standards. That's right. They want to reduce efficiency standards. Why is that? Because you're the saps on the end paying the bill. The coalition called on state regulators rather to strengthen, not weaken, energy efficiency programs to save consumers money on their power bills, to create jobs, to promote cleaner air. Members of the coalition held its Rally for Energy Savings outside the PSC hearing because inside the public was barred from the Public Service Commission hearing. Tells you how the public's being serviced, doesn't it? Representative Dwight Dudley telling the PSC to open the hearings to the public. In remarks just before the hearing opened, State Representative Dwight Dudley echoed the sentiments of the ralliers. The name Public Service Commission includes the public. The public should be heard on this, not hurt. Right now, they're about ready to get hurt, said Ennis Leon Jacobs, past chairman of the Public Service Commission. Increasing energy savings is a business opportunity, and Florida is ready to take advantage. Big utility companies like Duke, TECO, and Florida Power and Light should be bending over backwards to help Florida's economy. They can start by bringing their energy savings programs to the industry standards this year. Bill Buccolo, president of the Democratic Environmental Congress of Florida and leader of the coalition, called on the commissioners to reject the company's request to slash energy saving programs. Duke Energy, Tampa Electric, and Florida Power and Light have proposed to gut their energy saving goals by 93%. Hey, why not? Your wallet's open. Currently, none of Florida's major utility companies even meets the national industry standards for energy savings. Meanwhile, they're not doing the same for customers in Florida. Florida consumers should get the same opportunities and benefits as Duke's customers everywhere, said Kelly Martin, senior campaign representative with Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Ralliers also heard from Susan Glickman, Florida director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Action Fund, and Kim Ross, president of Rethink Energy Florida. They also spoke out against the utilities' attempts to undermine their ratepayers and the people of Florida. You should take action. Let the regulators know that you want the energy companies to be held to the highest standards for delivering energy savings and solar programs. Canadians can't drink their water after a 1.3 billion gallons of mining waste flows into the river. This from Think Progress. Hundreds of people in British Columbia can't use their water after more than a billion gallons of mining waste spilled into rivers and creeks in the province's Cariboo region. A breach in the tailings pond from the open pit Mount Poly copper and gold mine sent 5 million cubic meters, 1.3 billion gallons of slurry gushing into the Hazeltine Creek in British Columbia. That's the equivalent of 2,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools of waste, the CBC reports. Tailing ponds from mineral mines store a mix of chemicals, water, ground-up minerals left over from the mining operation. The flow of the mining waste, which can contain things like arsenic, mercury, and sulfur, uprooted trees on its way to the creek and forced a water ban for 300 people who live in the region. That number will grow as authorities determine just how far the waste has traveled. The cause of the breach? Hey, it's still unknown. So far, water use bans have been issued for the town of Likely, for people living near Poly Lake, Quesnel Lake, Hazeltine Creek, which flows into Quesnel Lake, the Cariboo Creek, as well as the Quesnel and Cariboo River systems. Authorities so far haven't issued water bans for the Fraser River, British Columbia's longest river, which is linked to the Quesnel River, which flows from the Quesnel Lake, saying it's not clear yet whether the effluent has made it to the waterway. What we know so far is that debris from the tailing pond backed up a little into Poly Lake, which absorbs some of the flow, but the majority of it went down into the Hazeltine Creek, said Ed Richmond, chairman of Cariboo Regional District, told the Vancouver Sun. The creek used to be 4 feet wide. Now it's 150 feet wide. Gee, you think there's some pollution in it? Now, the region is sparsely populated, which makes emergency response difficult. Richmond told the Vancouver Sun that only four people from the region's volunteer fire department were able to act as first responders to the disaster. Right now, authorities are working to test all waterways for contamination, a process that Richmond said he hopes will take no more than 48 hours. Richmond also said he didn't know whether or not the spill has been contained. So isn't that the question of the day? Clean water? We don't need no stinking water. And like I said, tune in to AveryVoice.com. You can check out the rest of the news we haven't got a chance to get to. And now, ladies and gentlemen, our first guest, Mr. Kofi Hunt. Kofi, welcome. Kofi, is that you? Okay, I guess we've just got an enthusiastic listener. There we go. Okay, so I will continue. Clean water? We don't need no stinking clean water. But twice this year, the water supply for a major American city was interrupted for days by water pollution. In January, a chemical used in the process of coal leaked from a ruptured storage tank into the Elk River, contaminating the water supply for 300,000 people in and around Charleston, West Virginia, the state's capital and the largest city. Then, last weekend, the water supply for 400,000 people in Toledo, Ohio, was declared unsafe because of the presence of microcystin, a toxin released by algae blooms in nearby Lake Erie, source of the city's water. Okay, now it's time for an update from Steve Horn from DeSmog Blog. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Steve Horn, fellow from DeSmog Blog, a premier environmental investigator. Steve, welcome. How are you today?
Doing well. Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Steve, it's our pleasure. Listen, you're a report of your stature is always an honor to have on our show. I understand you've been working on the links between ALEC and fracking lately.
Yes, I have. And ALEC's meeting just ended late last week, and part of the meeting was vote on two key model resolutions that centralized themselves around fracking. So one of them was on liquefied natural gas exports. The other one was on gas-powered vehicles, meaning compressed natural gas that comes from fracking. And so,
Steve, hold one second. Let me interrupt just for a second. Because if I understood you correctly, you're talking about this natural gas for export. And hasn't the whole argument about this, hey, anything goes, drill anywhere, do anything, was for American energy supplies? How did this get turned around?
Yeah, well, you know, that's what's been happening in the past few years, the industry trend. In 2012, the first export license was given to a company by the name of Cheniere, and while, you know, under the smokescreen of American energy and energy independence, quietly, three terminals total, including that one back in 2012, have now been permitted, and, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, this time around, has served as a key vehicle to, at least in terms of a model resolution, to push forward more export licenses. And so what I found was that this model resolution was written by Cheniere, which is the first company that I mentioned to receive that permit back in 2012. They originally passed a model resolution in Louisiana back in March, and there was a day called LNG Day. And if you look at House Concurrent Resolution 29 that passed, it was to commemorate LNG Day, or Liquefied Natural Gas Day. And if you compare the language in that to this model resolution that was voted on at the ALEC meeting, which ALEC did release that copy of that model resolution in a 35-day mailer they sent out 35 days before the meeting that just took place in Dallas, if you compare the two, the language is basically the same, except for some alterations that had to do with Louisiana back in March, and now this one was more general, but lots of the language was the same. And then I did a open records request that tried to obtain more information about the LNG Day, and it turns out that the whole LNG Day was put together by a lobbying/PR firm by the name of the Picard Group, and one of their key clients is Cheniere. And so if you look at their outreach to legislators and you look at who was CC'd, you see that they basically sent it to every legislator in Louisiana, but they CC'd Cheniere. And so then I just talked to Cheniere about it. Their lobbyist, Jason French, who attended the meeting last year in 2013, attended the meeting again this year and presented it both. And he did tell me that Cheniere he didn't really admit that they actually wrote the thing, but he did say that they were a big pusher and a big supporter of it behind the scenes leading up to the meeting. And so to me, it seems like pretty clear that Cheniere was behind all of it, and it makes sense. Cheniere is actually looking to get a second export terminal licensed and approved in Corpus Christi, Texas, although their first one has already been approved in Sabine Pass and opens late in 2015. And so ALEC all along has been a key vehicle to push through various aspects of fracking, whether it's lack of disclosure of the chemicals being injected into the ground during the fracking process, or whether it's attacking local democratic rights for city councils or town boards and getting rid of zoning laws. And now they're upping the ante, and now they're serving as a key vehicle for a company like Cheniere to push through bills to get more export licenses approved. And so this was just a resolution saying we as a state support LNG exports. It's not like it has any, it's not like a legal type of bill that mandates that it happens, but it's still important for, basically the fact that local journalists who write about this bill passing, and no one really mentioned this was originally written by Cheniere, and they won't really connect all the dots between one another, but the dots go directly back to Cheniere, who became an ALEC member back in 2013. And so since then, they've been very active, so much so that they probably, although I don't know for sure because it happened behind closed doors, this model bill probably passed last week at the Dallas meeting.
So just so for people who may not have heard too much about ALEC, could you give us a thumbnail sketch of ALEC?
Yes, I can. So ALEC has been around since 1973, although it wasn't really until probably a few years ago that very many people understood even what it does. And what ALEC does is it brings together predominantly Republican Party legislators, although there's some corporate Democrats that show up too, and then they all are at the state level in the 50 state houses, and they meet up at a couple meetings a year and vote on model bills. And so that means that also there are representatives of corporations, usually lobbyists, attorneys, sometimes executives. And behind closed doors at these meetings, which aren't open to the public, they vote on these model bills. And if the bills pass as models, then they get distributed to the 50 state houses. So Alec brags about the fact that it's passed thousands of these bills in state houses around the country, and often when they pass, at least until recently, and even now, it's not like we know everything that's Alec model bill, because none of it's all that transparent, although they've been forced to become more transparent in the past few years. Often people don't even know that it is an Alec model bill, so it just seems like it's something that legislators thought up on their own in the past. But what's been made clear is that Alec has served as a sort of a key vehicle to push through the corporate agenda in the state houses, and almost with no accountability until 2011, when this Alec Exposed project started at the Center for Media and Democracy, got their hands on 800 model bills from a whistleblower. And so lots of those model bills were traced back to state houses around the country. And since then, obviously, Alec is always introducing new ones at every meeting, including this recent one that I wrote about. So it's not as if they've become less active. They're still just as active as ever and still just as influential as ever.
So from your article, it seems that in addition to Chenier, also the T. Boone's Pickin' outfit, Clean Energy Fuels Corporation, seems to be also pushing this CNG resolution.
Yeah, exactly. And so that resolution was to equalize, standardize the measurement of CNG or compressed natural gas with diesel which means largely for 18-wheelers and larger vehicles. And so that's important because it creates sort of a new market and a new way of understanding the market for companies that produce these vehicles that have fleets. And so this was the dream of T. Boone Pickens for a long time. This is not the only step that's needed, but it's a key step, and it's something that his company has pushed for. If you look at press releases, if you look at coalition that they're part of, the Natural Gas Vehicles Coalition, the key industry lobbying force for natural gas vehicles, they've been pushing this big time, and it was actually voted on before the Alec meeting, just a couple weeks before that in Detroit. At the National Conference of Weight and Measures, they voted on this same resolution there and actually failed. And so Alec was like a second shot at it. And I'm not sure if it passed or failed there, but if it passed, I wouldn't be surprised. Some like UPS is one of the Alec members. I know that they've been pretty involved with the T. Boone Pickens plan for years. And getting their cars on fracked natural gas, their fleet on fracked natural gas. It's interesting just because I think to highlight, and I haven't actually written an article about this yet, except for mentioning it at the top of this other article. It's more about Chenier, but I will write about it. And what's interesting is that in 2011, I think a lot of listeners will realize that Alec is closely tied to the Koch brothers and Koch Industries and kind of this right-wing infrastructure that they've created. Well, in 2011, actually, Koch Industries was against something called the Nat Gas Act, which was a federal legislative version of the T. Boone Pickens plan. And they were against it because it was kind of corporate welfare. It was picking winners and losers, as they said. And so back then, they were out, their whole infrastructure was out lobbying against it. And now in 2014, actually, their infrastructure, they've supported a space for a model resolution supporting CNG vehicles to pass. It's an interesting turning of the tide where even T. Boone Pickens has been welcomed into this fray. And I think it shows that Alec is literally an open door for any type of corporate influence peddling. It doesn't matter even if before some corporations were against what they were doing, because even if there's contradictions in what happens there, there's still continuity in it. All corporate interests are welcome at the end of the day.
This LNG day wasn't just a little party hoopla for the boys in petroleum and natural gas. Actual legislation came from that, didn't it?
Yeah, right. So as I mentioned, that House concurrent resolution 29. Yeah, the PR day was important because it got picked up by the media, and it was just what they call earned media, where they put on basically media hoopla and easy press, and have to pay for the ads, and the media will run the story anyway and give it the spin they want. But on top of that, yes, out of that came this model resolution, or not even model resolution, it's a real state law to commemorate LNG Day. And that same language, of course, was picked up, and now it's part of this resolution to support liquefied natural gas exports. It's now an ALEC model resolution if it passed last week. And so that's important. On top of what else is important, I already mentioned the tie between the Picard group that put on that event and the fact that they lobbied for Cheniere. But one more thing I want to mention really quickly about the model resolution that passed or probably passed at the ALEC meeting is that if you look at the language in it, actually it's really similar to an article that Jason French, their state affairs lobbyist for Cheniere, that he wrote back in 2013 for their July-August issue of Inside ALEC. He wrote an article about LNG exports, and he talked about jobs numbers, and he cites the same exact figures, and actually in that magazine article, he has a footnote, and it links to this report that was written by the Perryman Group. And if you look back at that report, it was actually funded by Cheniere. So he's citing his own company's commissioned report that they funded that had their numbers in it, and it talks about how LNG exports would create something like 250,000 jobs, which is just an unbelievable amount of jobs. A quarter of a million jobs. And so, but no, it ties, it's interesting because the Perryman Group was actually also the same exact, so they're one of their clients is Cheniere, so look at their website, but another one of their clients is TransCanada, which, as listeners probably know, owns the Keystone XL pipeline, and they had this report that had equally kind of outlandish jobs numbers back in 2010, and then Cornell University actually wrote a counter study to that that showed that those job numbers were just kind of grossly overinflated. And so it's just interesting. Basically, the basis of part of this model resolution is a study that's not even cited in the model resolution. You have to look back at the other article he wrote that had similar numbers. So the basis of this is jobs numbers are just probably grossly overinflated, just like they were for the Keystone XL pipeline.
One more thing, if I can ask you one more question. It seems that these people are not just friends of Republicans. They have Democrats in high places, too, don't they?
Right. So Cheniere is amazingly politically connected at the highest levels. So obviously, through ALEC, this is a newer thing as of 2013 when it became a dues-paying active member. But even before that, they had, and it's the both sides of the aisle, at the federal level, they have connections. If you look at who's lobbying for them at the federal level, it's the former Secretary of Energy under President Bush, his firm, Spencer Abram, his lobbying firm lobbies for Cheniere at the federal level. If you look at their board of directors, they have just nominated to the board and accepting her nomination to the board was Heather Zyko, who was President Obama's climate czar, energy czar, his main aide on climate and energy issues in the White House. And also John Deutsch, who was former head of the CIA, he is on the board of directors. He was the former head of the CIA under President Clinton. So both sides of the aisle are covered by Cheniere. And I wrote an article like about a month ago or so that talks about before Zyko accepted that nomination, while she was still working for the White House, she met dozens of times with executives and lobbyists from Cheniere as a White House official. So definitely she offered an open door for Cheniere to get what it wanted when she was in the White House. And now after she's left the White House, she's joined Cheniere as a member of the board of directors.
Amazing. So it seems that these guys are as astute at mining the lobbyist game as they are mining natural gas, huh?
Absolutely, and so it would make sense why they were the first firm to get that final approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and why maybe they'll be lined up to get that second one in Corpus Christi, because more than any other firm, they've found these connections in high places. I've looked at all these LNG terminals, and no one's as politically connected and organized as Cheniere.
I like your closing comment in your article. Winning the public policy debate will continue to have a tremendous positive effect on the bottom line of your company, and that from a Tobacco Institute exec. Priceless. Absolutely priceless.
Yeah.
Steve?
Yeah. One quick thing about that before we close, I think it's important because that was written back in 1991. That was a letter from the former head of ALEC to a guy at the Tobacco Institute, and he was trying to recruit the Tobacco Institute to come to Alex, and that's on the Tobacco Archives up at online for University of Central Florida. They have the entire archives of basically discovery documents that came out from litigation, mass tort litigation against the tobacco industry. So it's interesting to show even the most unsavory characters. Alec was happy to have an open door to the tobacco industry, and even went so far as to recruit them in and tell them that by joining Alec, it will help them with their bottom line and profits.
Well, thank you again, Steve. We really appreciate you joining us, and you have a good day. Enjoy your summer, huh?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Steve. Bye-bye. While we're waiting for our good friend Kofi to show up, I'm going to read you another couple stories. This Fukushima meltdown worse than previously estimated. Hey, there's a shocker for you. Company releases new findings which show nearly all nuclear fuel melted in Reactor 3 following the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. The meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan was more severe than previously acknowledged. Again, what a shocker. Candor last in the race. The company released new estimates that nearly every fuel rod at Reactor 3, located at Plant 1, melted as a result of Japan's March 2011 earthquake and tsunami, and most likely fell to the bottom of the containment unit. The finding is far higher than the company's previous estimates, in which it told people that only 63% of the plant's nuclear fuel had melted. Furthermore, TEPCO's new statement acknowledges the fuel began melting 6 hours earlier than previously believed. It's still impossible for us to evaluate the potential impact of the findings on the decommissioning of the reactor, says TEPCO official, following the release of the findings, according to Japanese newspaper Asahi Shimbun. But as the Japanese newspaper, the Yomiuri Shimbun, reports, the finding may further complicate the troubled decommissioning of the plant. The paper explains, as the core meltdown is now believed to have started earlier than previously thought, the amount of melted nuclear fuel that passed into the containment vessel through the pressure vessel is considered to have been greater, making it technically more difficult to extract the melted fuel and eventually dispose of it. Hey, Florida legislature opens session for a plan with modest redistricting map changes. The rare summertime session was convened after a state judge ruled the legislature had drawn invalid map and had violated the fair district provision of the state's constitution. Tallahassee, Florida legislators opened their special session to rewrite the judicial redistricting map on Thursday and moved quickly to a fix not intended to take effect until 2016. Legislators halted their campaigns and fundraising, canceled family vacations for the rare summertime session convened after Circuit Court Judge Terry Lewis ruled last month that they drew an invalid map and had violated the fair district procedures the provisions of the state constitution. Lewis ordered legislators to fix two of the state's 27 districts by August 15th and said he would consider ordering a special election after November 4th for the affected districts. We are here because we have to get the congressional map right, said House Speaker Will Weatherford, Republican of Wesley Chapel, at the start of the special session. Hours after the gavel fell, House and Senate leaders filed a proposed rewrite that makes minor fixes to the two districts the judge ruled as unconstitutional. Two other proposed maps had merged as well, one by State Senator Daryl Soto, Orlando Democrat, and another by a coalition of left-leaning voting groups who filed the lawsuit and successfully persuaded Lewis to invalidate the congressional map. They're referring to, believe it or not, a League of Women Voters, which is about as left-leaning as, oh, I don't know, Ronald Reagan. In a letter to Weatherford and Senate President Don Getz, on Thursday, the League of Women Voters and Common Cause of Florida warned the legislative plan for slight alterations will not correct the constitutional defects that Judge Lewis identified and urged them to adopt their map as an alternative. Ladies and gentlemen, let me bring to you that fine activist from the West Coast. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Kofi Hunt. Welcome, Kofi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good, sir. Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm doing good.
That's good. So you've got a story to tell us about next week's conference, Kofi. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and then tell us about next week's conference.
Well, my name is Kofi Hunt. I've been an activist for 6 years and organizer for four. I've worked for a lot of different organizations, but my primary home is with the progressive networking table, Awake Pinellas, that is in Pinellas County, from St. Petersburg and Tarpon Springs. and I work on issues of social justice and economic democracy. And so next week, Saturday, August 16th, we're going to be having a conference, a statewide conference. It's going to be held in Orlando, Florida, at the UCF campus, and it's called Accountability 2014. And it's basically for us to come together, highlight our priorities for this election cycle and what we want, the message we want to get through, and to condense our different points into something palatable by people that are willing to be our champions.
So there's going to be some kind of report card created, I understand.
Yeah, we're going to look at what our priorities are as constituency groups, and then we're going to be looking up the records of the people who've been in office to represent us and see where they stand on those issues. Then we'll grade them appropriately, and then we will publish that for the larger progressive community to absorb and to see, you know, how the people who were elected to represent them are representing them in Tallahassee and in Washington.
So where exactly is this conference next Saturday?
Yeah, it'll be in Orlando at the UCF campus. We've had conferences there as well. It's a beautiful campus, and some of the students there have been gracious enough to help us navigate the campus procedures and get conferences there. So we'll be there, and we're hoping that a lot of students come as well as activists from all and organizers from all over the state.
The your background's a little noisy. If you could go to a slightly quieter place, that'd be awesome. But otherwise, let me ask you this. What time does the conference start?
The conference starts at 9:30 a.m. in the morning, and it'll go till 5:30 p.m. in the evening. It'll be a whole day, but we're stretching it out so that people don't get too worn out. We have a nice lunch in the middle.
And, you know, I've been to some of these conferences in the past. They've been really a lot of good presenters. Do you have any of the names of the presenters at the top of your head?
Yeah. We'll have people from the various AWAIT groups come and speak about their experiences and host different sections. Our keynote speaker will be State Senator Darren Soto. He'll speak about some of the bills that he's worked on and fought for up in Tallahassee, some consumer rights bills as well as bills associated with fracking.
And I understand the price is very reasonable.
Yeah, it's less than a local garage concert band. It's a $25. People spend more to go to the movies nowadays. We're just asking for a little bit to cover the cost of the conference and then and to supply lunch to everybody. And, you know, if they put in that little bit, they get a whole lot of return for their investment.
Excellent. Excellent. It's at in the center of the campus. Is it a student activity center or an auditorium or...
It is exactly located. Let's see. Here, let me see. Last time we did it, it was at the Student Activity Center. I know that. And this time, let's see.
Oh, that's okay. Don't worry about it. You can always drop me an email, and I'll include it in the show notes.
It'll be at the UCF Student Union, the Cape Florida Ballroom.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, if people would like to attend, they can go to flpros.eventbrite.com and just buy a ticket there, and all the information to get to the conference will be available.
Great. Is there a Facebook or a web page for the conference as well?
Yeah, you can look up the Facebook event, Accountability 2014 Conference.
Okay, Accountability 2014 Conference. It sounds like a must attend. I know I'll be there, and several of my good people I know in the activist community, and I'm sure that the good people from the Democratic Progressive Caucus will be there in mass. What else have you been working on lately, Kofi?
Lately, one of the biggest fights has been on immigration reform. In Pinellas County, we've held a strong rally that got a lot of media attention around the child refugee crisis. We see it as more than just an immigration issue. It's a humanitarian issue. We really want to highlight that aspect. Beyond that, here in St. Petersburg, we've been working to encourage more democracy, and we've been pursuing a ballot initiative to give 3% control of the city budget to the community. Direct control is an experiment to encourage more civic engagement and participatory activity in the government process. Beyond that, there's a lot of revving up, of course, for the elections to make sure that whoever wins through the primary, we make sure that this November we no longer have Governor Rick Scott as our governor for Florida. So, yeah, it's a real busy time, but we're going to keep our nose to the grindstone and make sure we keep moving forward.
Do you have any outstanding progressives running for either county office or city office in the St. Petersburg area?
For county office, we have a woman named Pat Gerard who's running for Largo. She's the current mayor of Largo. She's running for Pinellas County Commission. If she gets elected, we'll have a Democratic majority for the first time in Pinellas County since the 60s. So that should be really interesting. Yeah, and on the state level, we have the champion for the environment, Dwight Dudley, running for re-election. And we also have the comeback kid, Carl Zimmerman, running up in North Pinellas, both running for the state house for re-election. But we also have a really strong candidate running against one of the biggest neoconservative figures in the state in State Senator Jeff Brandis. We have Judith Ann McLaughlin Schofield running against him for the State Senate in State Senate District 22. She's a real strong contender. She has a doctorate in political science at USF St. Pete, and she has really run a really strong campaign, raised a lot of really great money, and reached out to a lot of people in the district. And we think that she has a great chance. Something exceptional for Jeff Brandis. In 2012, he was the only senator in the state Senate to vote against the compromised Medicaid expansion bill that would have accepted the federal money. So that lets you know what we have on the line here and who we're up against. And that's why we're running a really strong presence here to try to help people like Judith Ann get elected so we can keep moving the state forward.
Yes, as we say on tweet, pound, vote August 26th, right?
yeah, definitely. Vote August 26th. The school board, the judges, and all the primaries. And then in November, make sure you go out and vote to make sure that the state ends up scot-free.
You know, it seems that Senator Soto was also involved in that that gerrymandering hearing, and that he was one of the people to bring forward a better map. Have you been involved in that particular adventure?
No, I haven't been directly involved. I was involved in the hearings for the fair districts back in 2011. I was very involved in that. But this time I have just been sitting back and watching the show, you know. Tallahassee, unfortunately, a lot of times nowadays is a circus, and no one's laughing. So I think what we need to do is to send people up there that make sure that we get down to the real business of doing the work that the people of the state expect and deserve.
Well, you know, I agree that it's so important to keep people involved. With Tallahassee being so far away, both physically as well as psychologically, too many people have only paid attention when we get the bad news at the end of a session of what kind of mischief they've been up to. But I think it's great that you're helping activists stay focused on what's been going on, and as we approach another session, getting people geared up to really hold them accountable. That idea of an accountability festival, I think, is just absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've been at this with the, you know, since Florida Progressive started about 5 years ago and the Awake the State movement started about 4 years ago. We've been really keep consistently going at it. And I think that we're getting to a point where coming in, especially into 2015, but more importantly into 2016 and beyond, we're going to make serious waves in the state. And we're going to really define what a progressive is, I think, for the entire country, and a model that progressive activists and organizers can use to really start to change the way that this country works and by association in the world.
Well, we, thank goodness, have at least a few progressives up in Tallahassee. We absolutely have to get more of them up there. Is there an effort to, you know, give special support to the progressives that we do have up there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of what we do, is that we want to make sure that it's not just about us fighting the bad bills, it's about us promoting the good bills that represent our values. So, I mean, going after this conference, going into this, we will be connecting people to the champions that are standing up running for office, that are running for re-election, that do represent our values, absolutely. But going forward into the next Legi Camp, we'll make sure to champion, hopefully, I'm looking forward to having a scot-free state and getting down to the battle lines. And in January, when we have our next conference, which will be at Legi Camp 2015, at that conference, we plan on crafting our message around the champion bills and getting ready to fight the bad bills. And we'll make sure to stand, you know, arm to arm with the incoming Florida House leader, Mark Pafford, and making sure that we can really champion these strong bills, that those that represent our values.
Yeah, we just saw him at that that big water event in Stuart last weekend. And he was there, and gubernatorial candidate Nan Rich was there. It was really good to see a guy who's – he wasn't there to take a bow. He wasn't there to give a speech. He was there because he believes in the issue. And I think it's so important that we support the handful of progressives that we already have in Tallahassee and really focus on getting more of them up there. You know, you've been involved for quite some time in the progressive movement here in Florida. Do you think it's getting better? Do you see more people getting involved, or are you seeing a kind of an exhaustion with the whole political adventure? It can be frustrating.
I think that people are exhausted, but what I see is a refinement. What I see is us, we came out there, you know, with a swinging for the fences in 2011 because, you know, the worst case scenario had become reality. And what I see now is a refinement of a movement, people that have been in the trenches for 4 years now, who know what their values are, who know how to do the work. And all it comes to now is about spreading that technology in terms of those skills and those best practices out throughout all of the other activists and organizers that are dedicated to making a better state, making a better world. So I'm really optimistic looking forward, because I know that we have the capacity to take this sort of knowledge and spread it throughout the state and really show the entire country how you start to move forward and push back against these sort of politics that put communities and people by the wayside in favor of overwhelming profits.
Well, you know, I think it's very important, the defeat that the Republican attempt to thwart the will of the people has received in this Judge Terry's case. And, you know, granted, they're trying to still play their same games with it. But more and more people are watching, and I take great solace in that, because the more people are aware of this, the less people are going to be ignoring the process, and the less people who are just going to be essentially psychologically numb to the damage being done.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of hope, and it's not just like blind hope. I mean, if you look at where Obama won in 2012, and Obama himself looks at himself more as someone squarely in the middle as a president. He thinks that that's where he needs to be, and that's what he champions. But for progressives, I think that the fact that someone who is as Obama's campaign is seen as a very progressive campaign, and a lot of things that he stands up for, the same things we stand up for in favor of, like raising minimum wage, having more equality in income, having, you know, affordable health care and all those sorts of things, protecting the environment and, you know, whatnot. But it's like, if we had won the state house seats that he had won in 2012, we would control the state legislature. So the fact that he was able to win, that he was able to get votes in those same areas, means that we can get those votes and that we can get those people to come over to our side to vote for us, give us a chance. And we could take this state, I think, a lot sooner. You know, the thing is, if you look at where the people filed to run, the truth is there's a lot of seats that go uncontested. There's a seat up in North Florida that has 61% Democrats that has a Republican incumbent and had no Democratic challenger. And because people say, oh, it's North Florida, you know, there's a different kind of Democrats. Well, there are people that registered as Democrats. So I think that there's a type of Democrat amongst them that could run, reflect their values and ours, and could win. And that'd be one more step on the road to progress. So I absolutely
let me interrupt you just for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is that there are still seats that the Republicans can run unopposed, especially in a place where you think there's potential Democratic, Democratic demand in the public?
Because there's a narrative in politics that it's all about money. And the thing is, it's not. It's about people. And we have to start to really champion some campaigns to really show that, because we keep seeing it time and time again. Yeah, Alex Sink lost to Rick Scott, but she was outspent 17-1. Amanda Murphy won out in Pasco County, and she was outraised three times. Even up in the Midwest or the Mideast, Eric Cantor lost his race. He raised millions of dollars, and his opponent only raised $300,000. The fact is this, that elections are about people, and that money can only get you out there so much. And that when you don't have a good product, people know what a good product is, and that if we as grassroots organizers are willing to take our champions, take good progressive candidates, willing to go out there and talk to people in the community about what it means to elect this person, I think that, yeah, we can take these seats. And you know what? If the party, the Democratic Party, isn't willing to do it, then the progressive movement needs to take step to the forefront, and it needs to champion this thing, the same as all the other movements in the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the LGBT movement, the women's movement, pay forward and set new paths, and then the party and the politicians follow. If that's what we need to do, then we need to do it.
Well, I think you've got a great idea there. Let's let the politicians follow us. After all, they are civil servants, although sometimes they seem to forget that, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, Kofi, thank you so very much. Can you give us that Facebook site one more time so that the audience can write that down?
Yeah, if you search Accountability 2014 Conference on Facebook, you'll see it. And if you'd like to go directly to buying tickets, type flpros.eventbrite.com, and you'll be directed straight to the ticket site. It's only $25, and you get 8 hours of intense progressive thought and action moving Florida forward.
Well, thanks again, and say hello to Edwin for us, would you?
My pleasure. Will do. Take care.
Okay, we'll see you next week, Kofi. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Kofi Hunt, who's bringing us the latest update on the Progressive Conference next week, the Accountability 2014 Conference. We should have our next guest in just a minute, so I'm going to go ahead and do some more news. I know you'll be pleased to hear that rules prevent solar panels in many states with abundant sunlight. Can you say Sunshine State? Well, not with any help from the energy companies, that's for sure. Few places in the country are so warm and bright as Mary Wilkerson property on the beach near St. Petersburg, Florida, a city once noted in Guinness's World of Records for a 768-day stretch of sunny days. But while Florida had advertised herself as the Sunshine State, power company executives and regulators have worked successfully to keep most Floridians from using that sunshine to generate their own power. Wilkinson discovered the paradox when she set out to harness sunlight into electricity for the vintage cottages she rented out at Indian Rocks Beach. She would have had an easier time installing solar panels, she found, if she lived and put her house on flatbed and transported to chilly Massachusetts. Well, enough of that nonsense. Let me bring on our next guest, and I have to tell you, this is really a special pleasure on our part to have Mr. Houston Cypress with us. He grew up in the swamps of the Florida Everglades. The endangered beauty of the natural environment made such an impression on him that being a refuge for his ancestors and the source of traditional plant medicines, that today he articulates strategies for preserving this World Heritage Site. Houston Cypress is a two-spirit poet, artist, and activist from the Otter Clan of the Miccosukee Tribe of Indians of South Florida. He resides on the Miccosukee Reservation located west of Miami, Florida, and he maintains a number of traditional villages located on tree islands scattered throughout the Water Conservation Area 3A, an area known as the Historic River of Grass and called by his community Kahaiatele, which can be translated as Shimmering Waters. Mr. Houston Cypress, would you correct me on that? He combines art, communications, and spirituality through an organization he's helped to create known as Love the Everglades Movement. Mr. Cypress, welcome, sir.
Hey, good evening, Rick. It's good to talk to you. How are you doing tonight?
Sir, we are honored to have you with us tonight. We're doing great. And the reason we're feeling good is because, sir, this show is dedicated to the voices of the activists, the voices of the people that are actually working hard every day to make this a better world, sir. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and about the life you lived, and what made you an activist, sir? You know, so many people in this world, they have to work so hard to just make a living, to feed their family, to have a few friends, to have a little spare time. It takes a special kind of person to say, wait, in addition to making my family and having my friends, I'm going to make this a better world, sir. Tell us about yourself. What put you involved, and what made you stand up and say, I have to make this a better place?
Well, Rick, you know, I had some really good role models as I'm growing up out here in the Everglades just west of Miami. And the kind of role models that I'm looking towards are people like the medicine men and the medicine women who help to heal our community. They're really well connected with the plants, the colors, and our spiritual traditions that we've been given. So those are my first role models. We have a long line of medicine men and medicine women. More recently, I'm looking at people like my aunts and my uncles, who are the ones that are teaching me about how to maintain our gardens out there in the Everglades. They're those gardens we have on the tree islands out there. And so I look to them, their example. And I also look today at some of our tribal leaders and how they're really taking our message out there beyond the horizon and how they're trying to create alliances with the community, whether those alliances are on a state or federal level or whether those alliances are expressed through their arts and through the crafts and the visions that they create. So these are my role models. And so I've been taught the importance of keeping these traditions. And so I guess for me, activism is really about trying my best to honor these things that I was given and that I'm inheriting, whether it's how to cultivate corn on the tree islands out here, how to sing songs and ceremonies, how to use these plants for healing, or just how to maintain the connections that we have as a community within our society of clans. So for me, it's really about trying to maintain our traditions in the face of contemporary society, and that's really how my activism began.
And I you know, I had a chance to meet you through the work that some of the West Coast activists started to oppose these drilling in the Everglades. And, you know, it's wonderful to see so many communities coming together, whether it be the recreational people, the fishing people, your folks in the Everglades, to see all these threads coming together to weave a tapestry that is about honoring the earth instead of abusing the earth. How did you first hear about these folks on the West Coast fighting this good fight against the Dan A. Hughes people?
I first heard about these people through the work of the Conservancy of Southwest Florida and Jennifer Hecker.
Uh-huh.
Also was encouraged to make contact by the Green League of Broward up there in Broward. We also have some good Audubon Society. And so it's a matter of making friends, expanding our network, and we're really learning about this crisis with regards to this extreme drilling operations over there on the West Coast. So Karen Dwyer reached out to me and let me know about a demonstration that was going to happen over at the Hogan oil well site. And so I went over there and met up with them on a really hot summer day and got to meet with the people face-to-face and made friends with them. And so it was really direct action and lending our bodies on behalf of Mother Earth.
You know, I have I've worked with Mr. Tiger, Lee Tiger, in the past and tried to lend a few hands and help out with some of the events that were out there. And I was so pleased to hear about the event that you held out there with regarding your Love the Everglades movement. Could you talk about that event that you held, sir?
Sure. You know, I just want to back up and tell you a little bit about this work that we're doing with Love the Everglades. We consider ourselves a full-spectrum movement, and what we mean by that is that we're using all the tools and the techniques that's available to us. So these are things like arts, excursions or field trips into the Everglades, educational workshops, and starting from the very core of our being, our spirituality. So this work that we're doing was inspired by a vision that one of my friends had. His name is Gene Sarmiento. And so we've been good friends since we've been going to college. And so he had this vision, and I wanted to help him realize it. So we started doing these excursions back in December 2012, and we had been slowly building a network of friends and community by taking people out into the Everglades and giving them an opportunity to connect with the land and the water and the life which it supports. So after a year and a half of excursions out into the Everglades, we had created a pretty broad network of supporters and friends and allies. And with the crisis in the oil drilling and the fracking going on in the West Coast, we felt that it was a really good time to bring this network together. So I was inspired by people like the River Justice League and Eco Art South Florida up north of West Palm Beach. So we got our friends together. We really wanted to highlight the work that was going on, anti-fracking by Karen Dwyer, the Stone Crab Alliance, and Preserve Our Paradise. So that was really what brought this summer symposium together. This symposium that we had was about 2.5 weeks ago, and we held it over at the Miccosukee Resort on the reservation, and it was really nice to bring people together from all different parts of the South Florida. From the east, we brought people in from Biscayne Bay. From the north, we brought people in from West Palm Beach. From the west, Fort Myers and Naples. From the south, we had people talking about the national park. And in the center of the circle, we brought in the indigenous perspective with Miccosukee stories and artwork and history. So it was really, we felt like we were in a crisis situation with the fracking, and we wanted to highlight that, what's going on, what can we do about it. But by the time that the summer symposium came together 2 weeks ago, we were really happy that this immediate crisis was averted through the successes of people like Karen Dwyer and Jennifer Hecker, people working in the streets with direct action and people working in the courts through the legal system. So it was really nice to be able to have a little bit of a celebration at the symposium 2 weeks ago. And being a full spectrum movement, we were able to highlight all these different areas, the arts, the education, the politics, the spirituality, at the event that we hosted. So that's what brought us together, a little bit of a crisis, but we were able to bring a celebratory tone to it back in the, at the symposium 2 weeks ago.
Oh, that's so fantastic. You know, I understand that you've also been working in media yourself as well.
Yeah, personally, I've been working in film and television for the past 10 years with the Miccosukee tribe in different ways, but I also have my own independent production company, and so I've been doing projects in South Florida with organizations like the Film Recording and Entertainment Council and other projects. So that's what I've been doing, working in television and media, new media. But the people that are in our movement, they also work in multimedia as well, whether it's through the arts or even choreographing energy through our ceremonies and our rituals and things like that. So, yeah, we are multimedia.
Did I hear you got invited to a festival recently?
Are you talking about the River Rally?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have been expanding our network and making friends with people up there along the Indian River. And so they had a river rally. This is their second annual Save Our River Rally. And it was really nice to network with the people up there and see what their concerns are. So I had a chance to come up there, and I went up there with some of our friends from the movement to bring a message and to network with the people. And so it was really nice to stand in solidarity with the people and see how we're dealing with similar issues of poor water quality, which are affecting our ways of life, which are making our people sick, and which are preventing us from a good quality of life. And so it was really nice to have a little bit of solidarity and make new friends up there at that event last weekend.
I was wondering, you know, I realize that water analysis and testing can be an expensive proposition. I was wondering, have you either friends or through the tribe larger had a chance to do any water quality testing to see how things are going in the waters of the Everglades?
Oh, man, like, let me tell you, this is something that's really important to the community that I'm from. I'm from the Miccosukee community.
Right.
And so what the
Not
community does.
What's that? I just said it's not an academic issue if you're doing some subsistence farming and hunting.
No, not at all. But our community takes it seriously. So we combine our own traditional knowledge of the environment, and we integrate that with the scientific method. So what we've been doing twice a year for the past 30 years is in the fall and in the spring, we go out to 96 different locations throughout Water Conservation Area 3A, and we take a number of scientific measurements so that we have a log of data that can contribute to the projects that are concerned with Everglades restoration. So we take it pretty seriously. It affects our home, affects our way of life, and we're doing it on behalf of the children. But it also benefits the broader South Florida community, because once we have clean water in this area, this is something that's going to benefit the economy of South Florida, the tourism, the people that live here. So that's how this benefits a broader society.
Sure. You know, I tried fumbling through my pronunciation of shimmering waters. Could you tell us what the real actual pronunciation is, sir?
You did pretty good, Rick.
Well,
but,
thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
You did pretty good. So this is what it sounds like. The word is Kahayatli, and it means shimmering waters.
Kahayatli.
There you go.
There we go. Thank you so much. So,
yeah, brother.
When you were
Go ahead.
I was going to say, could you tell us a little bit about your youth?
Sure. I grew up out here west of Miami on the Miccosukee Reservation, and so a lot of my time was spent blazing trails through the bushes, through the swamp, getting muddy, riding in canoes. I'm a tree climber. I love to climb trees. And so that's how I spent my years as a youngster. And then as I got a little bit older, I'm going out there and learning about cultivating gardens and building chickies and things like that. I was really honored to have a good relationship with my grandfather before he passed away, because he passed on to me some of the traditions of artwork, wood carving, and initiated me a little bit into some of the spiritual teachings of our community.
Are you on the medicine path too, sir?
No, I'm not. And, you know, there's a really big respect for that in our community.
Sure.
But I'm not at the point in my life where I can dedicate my time to that. But there we have a good understanding of how we can use this for first aid. And then there's a deeper understanding of it, which has to do with, like, spiritual teachings and things like that. But at this point in my life, I have a good respect for it, but I'm not a student or a trainee of it, no.
Oh, I see. Could you explain something else? I've been a person who studied religion and done comparative religious studies for many, many years, so I am intrigued. When you you mentioned in your bio that you're a two-spirit poet, could you tell us what that means, sir?
Sure. Well, this understanding of two-spirit, it's really a broader and international movement of decolonization. And when I say international, I'm really talking about between tribes, between tribal nations. And so this understanding of two-spirit is really about not necessarily to do with sexuality, but more to do with gender. And so in the world, you can consider a very simple understanding of humanity as being a binary system. We're talking about males and females. But in indigenous cultures and in indigenous societies, we have a broader understanding of gender. So that could be a third or fourth or even a fifth gender in tribal societies.
Ah.
And so this could be considered like LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered understandings of indigenous people.
Uh-huh.
But even that sort of an understanding is a little bit problematic, because that kind of reduces people to what they do in the bedroom. And there's so much more. So this understanding of two-spirit is really about connecting with our traditions, being in our communities, having a respect for our spirituality, and it really is a broader understanding and a broader embrace of humanity and our expression. So
that's wonderful.
It's actually reconnecting to our traditional understandings before European settlement on this continent. So it's reconnecting to the things that we have lost, reconnecting to the things that we have hidden, and bringing that forth in a respectful and committed way within our own communities.
One other thing I was going to ask you, could you tell us a little bit about the Otter Clan, sir?
Oh, that's pretty cool. Thank you. You know, I'm going to give you a little bit of a joke, but I mean it just for fun. The Otter Clan, you know, is really the Hotter Clan. But I say that with all due respect to other clans within our society. I'm from the Miccosukee community, the Miccosukee tribe, and our tribe is really a society of clans. And so we have clans like the Panther family, the Bird family, the Otter family, the Wind, the Toad, and so on. And so these are the large extended families that really make up our tribe, and I'm just a part of the Otter family or the Otter clan, and we're just one of many families within the tribe. I have a lot of respect for all the clans within our community, but just for fun, I like to say the Otter clan is Otter clan.
That's wonderful, sir. You know, the Love the Everglades conference and movement that you're working in, do you anticipate this being an annual event, sir?
Yes, we do. We're already planning for next year. We want to be able to continue this idea of being inclusive and reaching out to other communities and collaborating in a way that's respectful with other communities.
Sure.
We really want to inspire other people, other communities, to do this work on behalf of the clean water. So we want to be almost like cheerleaders for inspired
sure.
action. So we're working on that. We also want to keep this spirituality as an integral part of our movement.
Right.
So we're going to be planning Everglades prayer circles in the city at different locations.
Excellent.
It's going to be an interfaith ceremony.
Uh-huh.
We also want to work on the ground. We want to see progress made on the ground. So one of the things that's really important to us is finding a solution to the L28 Interceptor Canal, which is bringing high phosphorus into Water Conservation Area 3A. And we're supporting spending public monies in a way that makes sense. So what I mean is that rather than building expensive skyway bridging along Tamiami Trail, let's work by cleaning out the existing structures that are already in place while we work on this really hard job of cleaning up the water. So there's a lot of actual tangible goals that we have. But like I said, we're trying to use all the tools and techniques that are at our disposal to achieve these goals.
You know, I'd like to put a thought, sir, in your thinking about it. I think it would be wonderful if that kind of event could be streamed live so that people from the broader areas can understand more about the Everglades and can participate even in remote locations. So I'd be glad to help you with that, work with you on that. Too many times, wonderful, fantastic, amazing events like that happen, but only a few people can come. And if I can be a small bridge to help that, I would be honored to help you, sir.
Rick, I'm definitely going to take you up on that.
Well, sir.
Another one of the challenges that we're dealing with is the language barrier. So we're working on translating all our materials into Spanish. And
excellent.
You can also check out videos of the last conference, the symposium, online at our website, lovetheeverglades.org.
Excellent. That was my next question, sir. I was going to say, where can people find out more about Love the Everglades? You know, people have to have the kind of special attention to even appreciate the beauty of the Everglades. Too many people drive across, whether it be Tamiami Trail or Alligator Alley, and you know, it's just a way spot between two locations. And it takes a special love of nature, a special love of the Everglades to really bring that to their awareness. And I thank you so much for the work that you're doing to make people love and appreciate and take care of the Everglades for the future generations. So lovetheeverglades.org. Is your artwork there as well?
Yes, you can find my artwork as well as the artwork of the people in our coordination circle. And we also have a section on the page where we say a page that says Friends. And there we also have a number of artists and organizations listed that are doing great work that we support. People like Eco Art South Florida, artists like Eva Ruiz, Alyssa Christine. So you can go to our website and find out all the artists and projects that we're supporting throughout South and around the world.
Well, sir, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real honor to have you with us. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave the audience with, sir?
Well, I'd like to extend an invitation to your listeners. You can send us a tweet at Everglades Love or hit us up on the website lovetheeverglades.org. We've scheduled a number of Everglades field trips for the rest of the year, so if you're interested and you want to come visit and connect with the land and the water, hit us up through the website. We'd love to host you and your listeners, so the invitation is open.
Thank you so much, sir, and may you have sweet water.
All right. Enough respect, Rick. I look forward to seeing you out here soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ciao.
That was our brother, Houston Cypress, of the Otter Clan of the Miccosukee, giving us his insight into the Love of the Everglades campaign and his work with activists from both coasts who are trying to preserve the Everglades, not just for today, but for the future, for the children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren. Thank you so much. Now, ladies and gentlemen, We've got some announcements and some news pieces from Senator Elizabeth Warren. First, she's going to talk about college tuition and the problems with the current system of college tuition.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, borrowers who are in serious financial trouble, either because they've lost a job, they've lost a spouse, they've hit serious medical problems, can get a fresh start on pretty much every kind of debt by declaring bankruptcy. They can deal with credit card debt, they can deal with mortgages, with payday loans, but student loans are treated differently. There's essentially no discharge, no matter how much trouble you're in or why you're in trouble. Federal student loans have been excluded from bankruptcy since 1998, and in 2005, the bank successfully lobbied Congress to end bankruptcy protection for private student loans as well. Now, the federal government at least offers federal borrowers programs for loan modifications, for default rehabilitation, and for income-based repayment, as we were just talking about, that at least give people some chance to get back on their feet. Look, it's nothing like a fresh start in bankruptcy, and the federal government's still making huge profits off these loans, but at least it's something. Banks, by comparison, get the benefits of the bankruptcy exclusion and don't offer much of anything in exchange to help struggling borrowers. So last summer, the federal regulators, including the FDIC, the OCC, and the Federal Reserve, made it crystal clear that private student lenders could offer loan modifications like reduced interest rates to struggling borrowers without any penalty. But according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, banks still effectively aren't offering that help. So what's the impact of that? Well, just 3 days ago, CNN published a story that gave an idea. It was a story about a woman who died, leaving her parents to care for three small children, and also leaving them with $100,000 in student loan debt that the couple had co-signed. I think I just heard Mr. Hunt say that the private student loans have about a 97% co-signing rate. So the grandparents of these little children contacted the private lenders, but they couldn't get much help to manage the huge monthly payments. The couple considered bankruptcy over their daughter's student loan debt, only to discover that bankruptcy is not an option to them. So here's my question. If struggling borrowers can't discharge their loans in bankruptcy, and if your banks won't give them loan modifications, Mr. Hunt, what are they supposed to do?
So, Senator Warner, thank you very much for the question. We share the same concern you do, is making sure that we do everything we can to make sure that students' debt is paid off in a timely manner. Especially when you have life circumstances that arise. Very tragic incident that happened. I saw that on CNN and also read the extensive report by Senator Reid on Christopher's Law. I do not agree with you when you say there's not many options for people to refinance. Citizens Bank, which has a huge presence in Massachusetts, headquartered in Rhode Island, does offer now refinancing.
Now, wait. Let's just be careful here when we're talking about refinancing.
Sure.
We're not talking about performing loans, and you like to reach out to your customers and say, have we got a deal for you? We'll lend you some more money. Here's refinance. We're going to change your interest rates. What I'm talking about are loan modifications that reduce the interest rate, that forgive interest, that reduce principal. Do you have any data suggesting that the banks are doing this? Because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says they're not.
Well, I think it's very important, Senator, that when a person does restructure the loan for a lower interest rate, it is loan modification. It is refinancing.
So
Massachusetts, there's $126 per month savings for your constituents. And in Rhode Island, it's $149 just by Citizens Bank doing a refinancing.
So that's my question again, Ms. Hutt. Are you telling me that all banks today in America, or even a majority, do you have some data to suggest how many are offering loan modifications for student borrowers that will reduce interest rate or will reduce principal for them? Do you have some data on that?
I will tell you, when it comes to refinancing, the actual amount of the interest rate, it's Discover, Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo has been doing this for 10 years.
The question was, do you have any data to suggest that the banks are offering the kinds of loan modifications that will help people who are in financial trouble get a chance to get back on their feet? After all, Mr. Hunt, The banks lobby to get non-dischargeability in bankruptcy. The question I started with here is, what are people supposed to do? What is this family supposed to do that now has three children to take care of and $100,000 in non-dischargeable student loan debt from a child who died?
So, Senator, thank you. Two things. There is now loan forgiveness for a student who passes away. Many of our banks are now formalizing that into their contract.
You're telling me that this is now available from all banks, that there is loan forgiveness, and this couple can take advantage of this loan forgiveness since their daughter died? I hadn't heard this.
That is mostly right. That is mostly right.
I don't understand what mostly right means. Is it available or not?
There are not all banks. There are many more banks that are giving loan forgiveness throughout the country.
What number is many more? More than zero?
Yes, ma'am. There are more than zero. In fact, I know of about at least four that are doing it right now.
Four out of 7,000?
Well, not all 6,700 banks provide student lending, and we don't represent all 6,700. I will tell you, one large institution since 2011 has forgiven $26.8 million because the student unfortunately passed away. I think you're going to see more of our banks formalize that, enter their contract. When a student does pass away, are going to start forgiving.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. And when it goes from 4 to 8, I'm sure you will announce that you've seen 100% increase.
Well, keep in mind, Senator, you only have about 8 banks that dominate the market. So we're making progress. A lot of these banks do it by case-by-case scenario. There's nothing worse than the tragic accident that happened throughout the country.
Yes, actually, there is something worse. And that is when something like this happens, and the family is left with $100,000 in debt and three orphans to take care of. That's worse.
And I'm hoping that bank forgives that loan.
Well, I'm hoping that bank will forgive that loan, too.
Sure.
So far, what that bank has said is no. The banks have not forgiven those loans. They have not provided adequate relief to this family. And I don't know how many other families are in those circumstances. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there really is no substitute for bankruptcy protection. But the banks went out and lobbied to make sure that they were going to be exempt from the bankruptcy laws, and now they won't even provide the modest relief that is provided on federal loans for people who end up in terrible financial circumstances. I think this is wrong.
And now another speech by the glorious activist progressive Senator Elizabeth Warren. Vote progressive. Vote August 26th.
Madam President, our tax code is tilted toward the rich and the powerful. Huge corporations hire armies of lobbyists and lawyers to create, expand, and protect every last corporate loophole. That's how we end up with a tax code that makes small businesses and restaurants and construction companies pay, that makes teachers and truck drivers and nurses pay, but that allows huge American corporations to make billions of dollars in profits and not pay a single dime in taxes. The tax code is rigged. Apparently, even this rigged game doesn't go far enough for some corporations. Those companies taking advantage of a new move, a loophole that allows them to maintain all of their operations in America, but claim foreign citizenship so they can cut their U.S. taxes even further. Tax lawyers call this process a corporate inversion, but don't let the bland name fool you. These companies are renouncing their American citizenship, turning their backs on this country simply to boost their profits. They are taking advantage of all the good things that our government helps provide: educated workers, roads and bridges, a dependable court system, patent and copyright protection, and then running out on the bill. If a person did that, we call them a freeloader. We'd insist they pay their fair share, and that's exactly what our tax laws do for people who renounce their American citizenship. For a person who doesn't want to pay a fair share, our message is clear. You can renounce your citizenship, but don't come back and expect the rest of us to pick up the tab. But we don't do that for corporations. Corporations can renounce their American citizenship and make absolutely clear in legal documents that they're doing it to avoid their U.S. tax obligations, and not suffer any consequences. In this corner of the tax code, we've gone way past treating corporations like people. In this corner of the tax code, we're treating corporations better than people. That's not right. That's why I've teamed up with Senator Levin and more than a dozen of our Democratic colleagues to introduce the Stop Corporate Inversions Act. The bill is simple. It allows American corporations to renounce their citizenship only if they truly give up control of their company to a foreign corporation and truly move their operations overseas. President Obama and Secretary Liu have spoken out in favor of the proposal. I commend their leadership, and I join them in urging the Senate to pass this bill right away. But the administration doesn't need to wait for Congress. It can use its existing authority to slow down and reduce the attractiveness of these sham inversions right now. America is a great place to do business because of the investments we have made together. In Massachusetts and across this country, we invest in public education in our colleges and universities, producing millions of skilled workers. We invest in infrastructure, in our roads and bridges and ports, making it easier for our companies to move their products across the country and beyond. We invest in scientific and medical research, giving our companies access to the most innovative and cutting-edge technologies. We invest together to make America a place where any kid will have a chance to come up with an idea and turn it into the next great American corporation. The companies that are pursuing these corporate inversions know all of this. That's why they are not actually leaving America behind. They just don't want to pay for it. Our achievements aren't magic. They didn't simply happen on their own or through dumb luck. America works. Our government works. Our democracy works because we all pitch in and do our part to build the things that none of us can build alone, the things that give everyone a chance to succeed. If these companies want to leave all that behind, well, that's their right. But if they exercise that right, if they leave America behind, then they shouldn't get to turn around and claim all the privileges of being an American company. We've had enough of rich corporations taking whatever they want and expecting everyone else to pick up the pieces. The time for freeloading is over.
And now, you may know it, we're already at war again in Iraq. And now I got this word from the military-industrial complex.
A word from the military-industrial complex. First we fund them, then we bomb them. First we fund them, then we bomb them. First we Fund them.
So stay tuned next week when there'll be new terrorists that we train and fund and then blow up. And now, this word from our last guest of the evening, Miss Meredith Ackman.
Hello, this is Meredith.
Hello, Meredith. This is Rick Spisak, Progressive News Network. How are you today?
Hey, Rick. I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Well, Meredith, I wanted to call you and get your take on some of the issues that have been pressing on America's women and the world's women these days. Meredith, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about you in case they don't know about you yet. So let's start with that. Meredith, how'd you get involved in women's rights, in human rights?
Well, I think, I've been on the show a couple of times. I think your audience knows a little bit about me, but, some of the things that they may or may not know about me is that I have an older brother and two sisters. My twin sister was born with a deformity, so I've been speaking out for people who weren't able to speak up for themselves for a long time. I'm also Jewish, and I have Holocaust survivors in my family, and that plays into making sure that people are spoken for who can't speak for themselves as well, and protecting people's rights.
And I understand you just had a new position offered in the women's rights arena. Could you tell our audience what your new title is?
Actually, I ran a successful campaign for the Southeast Regional Director position for National Organization for Women. So I'm actually able to represent 7 states in the Southeast region of the country on the National NOW board, which means that my voice is going to extend out further than Florida, which is where I've been mostly doing my activism and my work.
Well, of course, the show wants to congratulate you because we know what wonderful work you have been doing, and it's nice to see a wonderful activist like yourself getting even a larger arena to work in.
Thank you. Well, of course, I'm still working in Florida. I still have, you know, my local positions that I've worked on, and so I'm not going anywhere.
Well, good for us, and the world is going to have to wait a little bit. I can't help but think of you and the work that you're doing when I hear things like, well, let's say, for example, the Hobby Lobby case where the federal Supreme Court has decided that it's okay for corporations' religious values to take precedence over the human rights and responsibilities they have toward their employees. I was wondering if you could give us your take on that situation.
Well, actually, first of all, I want to clarify that statement because it's indirectly the case that you're correct that they have taken away the rights of their employees. But no corporation has, nor the religious beliefs of the owners of said corporations, have been asked to supply any employee with birth control or anything else, as a matter of fact. What we were asking was that the insurance companies provide coverage for health care for the people who work for those companies. And so directly, those companies would never have to have paid individually for the care that their employees would be receiving. It would be the insurance companies that would cover that cost.
Correct, of course. But ultimately, the upshot is that they've made it more difficult for some care to be made.
Oh, absolutely, unequivocally. And the thing is that my primary issue with that being the case is that a corporation, contrary to belief, you know, to some people's belief, doesn't have the ability to have emotions or beliefs. The corporation, because it protects its owners, is a separate entity from those owners and their beliefs in many cases, and therefore it doesn't have the ability to have a religious belief or any belief otherwise as well. So if its employee has a belief that's different from the owner of the company's belief, that would be outside of the scope of what would actually take place in the business realm, and that's where I have the issue. So no corporation is a person. That's just not the case. And so, you know, when the Supreme Court delivered corporate personhood to companies, it did an incredible disservice to the working force, and it ultimately, I believe, you know, it took an opportunity for jobs away from a lot of people who need it and who are people who contribute to our society. So it's, you know, it's a huge disservice that they've done. The Hobby Lobby case is no different than that, as far as them continuing to take away from people. And it's, you know, what I believe that government should be making life better for the people that it's taking care of. And I think in this case, the courts have done, you know, have ensured the opposite of that. And so hopefully the Senate and Congress can come up with some resolutions with the president who will be able to sidestep those issues, and that's what I'm hoping for at this point. I believe that there is some work around that issue, but you know, we're not going to know until it happens or if it happens. So
another contemporary news story that I wanted to run by you and get your insight on. I'm not happening to be a big follower of the football game circuit, but it's hard if you're concerned about human rights to avoid this story, where a gentleman named Mr. Rice was videotaped beating his wife and dragging her around, and he got a 2-game suspension, but another football player, Mr. Gordon, was caught smoking marijuana, and he got a year-long suspension. It seems that while on the one hand we've made some progress in human rights for women and in how women are treated, but then again something like this happens, and it can't be perceived any other way than devaluing the dangerous behavior of beating people that you love, theoretically.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, honestly, you know, public opinion is going to take care of that, I'm hoping, and we'll see some kind of feedback from the public. I personally have made some calls about it because I was definitely disillusioned by the decisions that they've made, but I really believe that the court system should be doing something about that case, and especially considering that there's such abundant evidence, and there ought to be somebody who steps in as far as legalities are concerned, and I think that's where that belongs. You know, as far as the decision of the NFL to you know, for his suspension from just a couple of games, you know, I don't think it's steep enough. I think that these players are taught to be extremely violent, and I think that's what football is mostly about. It's one of the reasons I'm not a huge fan of football, but part of that comes off the field with them because, you know, it's difficult to separate those things. That's why so many of our soldiers come back with PTSD. And I believe that this is part of it, that you know, this player was taught to be violent, and he took it out off the field, and he abused his wife, and he needs to be, you know, shown the door in a lot of ways. I think that the court system should be taking care of that.
Yeah, you know, it also seems odd to me that we're hearing about the primary kind of pivot of this story is what the NFL has done about it. If this person has been videotaped beating his wife, why are we not hearing about the case in court? Why are we hearing about it in the case in the arena of NFL suspensions? You know, why aren't we hearing about his arrest and prosecution, you know?
Well, no, I mean, exactly. I'm not sure if that's, I don't understand why we're not seeing more of that side of it. Perhaps it's the case that they're not able to talk about it yet because it hasn't been decided on. You know, perhaps the laws in Baltimore, I believe it's Baltimore, prevent them from having that conversation or from charging him if his wife is willing to or not willing to press charges. You know, there's a lot of different, you know, things that come into play in a case like this, and unfortunately I'm not personally involved with it, so I wouldn't, you know, I don't have direct information on that case, but I think that there's, you know, there's definitely legal precedent to that, you know, that would throw the book at him, especially with the evidence that's there, provided that they actually prosecute. So, you know, I hope that the prosecutors decide to do that. You know, up until at this point, we don't know what they're going to do.
Another set of court issues that kind of juxtapose issues and progress and retreat. On the one hand, the court has removed the distance guidelines for protests around abortion clinics and women's health clinics. But on the other hand, here in Florida, the sound restrictions that were being opposed have been supported. Could you weigh in on those?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Actually, I've been escorting at Presidential Women's Center for the last 11 years. And I can tell you that over the course of that time, the protesters have been extremely aggressive, even having had having firebombed us, the clinic at one point.
Right.
When nobody was actually there, and that was in 2005. Around that, after that time frame, the commission decided to allow for us to have a noise ordinance, and for a very brief time, we had a buffer zone that was then taken back into the court and was thrown out by a federal judge, who really did not hear the case. I was sitting in the courtroom for it, and it was an extremely, it was probably the most infuriated that I've been with the legal system, because he really didn't give her the opportunity to present the case from the side of the pro-choice, the pro-choice side. So anyway, the first of all, let's talk about the buffer zone. So in Massachusetts, they had a 35-foot buffer zone, and the courts claimed that that wasn't that was too far for the protesters to stand in order to be able to still have freedom of speech. Not taking into consideration what we have from in Florida, which in particular is where the noise ordinance comes in, because we do have a noise ordinance in Florida, and specifically at Presidential Women's Center in West Palm Beach, that supports a buffer zone of 100 feet for the noise ordinance. So they're not allowed to use amplified devices of any sort within 100 feet of the property line for Presidential Women's Center. What that does is makes it so that our patients can walk in with minimal disturbances from the protesters, who still stand out there and yell. They're just not allowed to use the bullhorns or the more aggressive sound amplifying devices that they used to use. It's made a huge difference in the ability to take care of our patients as we're walking in with them, and they're not nearly as upset when they walk in as they had been when these people were much more aggressive and much scarier. We're still having the issue with the fact that we don't have a police detail out in front of that clinic anymore. We have security, but not police detail. We had had a police detail on that site for over 30 years, and this year the commission decided to pull that police, that off-duty police officer that the clinic paid for, for whatever reasons they chose.
We find ourselves in a situation where while women have the theoretical right to choice to have an abortion if they deem it necessary, and yet across the South especially, we see legislatures tampering with health regulations to basically reduce the choice to traveling to another state.
Well, and ultimately, the people that it hurts most are the people who are most impoverished in our communities. If you look at Texas, for example, in Texas they used to have 41 clinics across the state, and the rules and regulations that the conservatives have chipped away at has prevented most of those clinics from being opened, to the point where there's now 5 clinics, and they are even threatened at this point across the state of Texas, which is just huge. Somebody with resources can obtain the ability to travel from one place to the other to go and have whatever procedure is necessary. But the people who are most impoverished, the people who don't have those resources, that don't have money to go and from one state to the other or from one area of the state to the other, are the ones who are really suffering. And I know that there are organizations that help women who need that to get from one place to the other, but there's not nearly as much help as we need. Emergency medical assistance is a perfect example, and they do such incredible work with helping with private fundraising so that they can get so they can help subsidize the cost of abortion for women who need it. And listen, you know, Rick, there's nobody who is pro-abortion. I don't think there's anybody who is pro-heart surgery either. But we know that these are necessary procedures that have to be done sometimes. And, you know, I support the ability for us to do heart surgery to save somebody's life and for abortion when we need to save the quality of life for somebody. So, you know, I think it's really important to distinguish and, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, there are no organizations that have prevented more abortions than organizations like Planned Parenthood and like NOW, who have rallied and done preventative work, than there is no other organization that's done more preventative work than those organizations for when it comes to abortion. So supporting Planned Parenthood and organizations like NOW is the key to making sure that we have the ability to continue to take care of people.
You know, it seems to me that you're in a unique vantage point to think about those distance guidelines. You're a person who's actually stood on the front line and helped escort women in there. What ran through your mind when you heard these distance guidelines removed?
You know, we're in a really lucky position in Palm Beach County where the regulations that have been put in place and the way that we are positioned on the property, we have the ability to get people onto the property within their vehicles and then walk in with them so that they're on the property already and there's still a lot of harassment and a lot of scary people that stand outside that are protesting. But when I first started doing the work clinic escorting, of patient escorting, I did the research and found out that, you know, there are clinics across the country where their property line doesn't have a parking lot on it. So what would happen is, in order for those patients to get into the clinic for the care that they desperately need, the escorts would need to link arms and stand up against the chain link fence and then take a step forward without pushing against these protesters who are right in their faces, who are right up against them, and let the patient walk past them behind them with these people yelling at them and harassing them and scaring them. And then once the patient has walked past, they take the step back again so that they're up against that chain link fence again. And those are people, you know, those are extremely volatile. You know, it's volatile enough for us to be in danger standing outside to walk somebody into the clinic in Palm Beach County, but those are extremely dangerous situations where you have people that close to each other who are angry and who are, you know, where those people, you know, on one hand you've got the patient walking in with, you know, who's scared and who's, you know, because she's having a procedure, and any procedure is a little nerve-wracking. But put that on top of these angry people on the other side of that equation, and you have a recipe for real danger at hand.
You know, go ahead.
And that was my primary concern, because you're only talking about 35 feet. That's not very far if you look at the scope of, you know, of what the range of a voice can do. You know, that's my real concern, is that those close borders, that close proximity to the patient, where it's going to take a lot more to get that patient in a place to have the procedure.
My wife and I attended in opposition to a anti-choice protest at a Kendall facility, and I brought a large Cupid that I'd used in another event, and on the back of this large 5-foot-long, 3-foot-tall Cupid, I wrote, "Support pluralism."
Nice.
And I had some of the anti-choice people come up to me and say, "Well, what does a Cupid have to do with an anti-abortion protest?" And I said, "Well, I don't know about your behavior, but to me, sex and love are intimately entwined." And they said, "Well, you wouldn't want your mother to have an abortion, would you? And I said, well, if she had, then I wouldn't be here to protest you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The clinic in Kendall was one like you just described, where literally they had a sidewalk was all that was between them and the street. So there was quite a bit of shouting and the kind of hideous posters that those people who want to share their religious values tend to bring to those things. It was a very ugly scene.
As far as those posters are concerned, I think they should be considered pornographic. If it was in a movie, it would be considered, PG-13, or it would be considered rated R, that sort of thing. And for them to be able to stand out there with those posters, you know, with children who are there, who might be driving by, who might be walking, you know, we've all seen some of those gruesome movies in the past, but for them to have those posters out in a place where people would see it, it's really, a lot of them are fake in the first place, but to put that out there I believe it's unacceptable, and I believe it borders on pornographic material. I think that it should be considered illegal, but, you know, that's a fight for another day.
Right, right. Violence is okay on our TV, just not sex, you know.
Right.
let me ask you another question. We've got we have an interesting situation here. We've got a woman running for the Democratic candidacy of governorship of Florida, and it looks like there's a good chance we may have a woman running for president on the national level. How do you see the state of women's rights in 2014? What's your perspective?
Well, you know, I think that we've had women run in the past. I'm really concerned on a lot of levels, and I think that the scrutiny that women are put under when they run for office is much higher than that of men, partially because there's so much more commonality in a man running for office than a woman running for office. One of the reasons that I joined on the board of the Florida National Women's Political Caucus is because our primary focus and goal is to make sure that there's equal representation on the within the government that asks us to follow its laws. And, you know, the whole idea behind the founding of our country was ensuring that we have equal representation before taxation. And so when you look at that issue, we don't have equal representation within the government. We don't have somebody speaking on our behalf if specifically having to do with women's issues. So I do believe that we need more women in government. With that said, when I say women, I mean women-friendly politicians as well, including my friend Mark Packard, for example, who I've said in the past is one of the best women I know. because when it comes to women's issues, we have people like Ted Deutch who will stand up there and say the same things that Lois Frankel says, and those are good women. Those are good they're people who are good feminists. And they do a good job of making sure that we're represented, and we need more women to go up and bring the issues that are more well-rounded into the community. So instead of Congress, of the House...
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you'll join us again, and also join our fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden-Berry, her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her Wise Woman Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report out of Sarasota, Sita Baguil, the Sita Media Show, and Harriet Lerman, Voice of the People. Tune in again next week. We'll be focusing on some issues of Central Asia and the Mideast. So see you next week. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network, saying thank you so much for joining us. And we'll talk to you soon. Good night.